Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry will share dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. Along with this month's tape, summary and outline, and customer response card, you will also find another flyer on Grandy & Associates' newest tape series called Service Sense. The first Service Sense tape for technicians went out the end of January. Over half of you have already ordered the new tape series, and I know enjoyed the first tape entitled The First 2 Minutes. For those of you who have not signed up, simply fill in the enclosed order form, and we will rush a copy of the January tape to you. Isn't it worth $99.95 a year to train your technicians in customer service and add-on sales? This month's tape is by Roger Dawson. Roger is one of the country's top experts in the art of negotiating. Success Magazine calls him America's premier business negotiator. His cassette program, Secrets of Power Negotiating, has passed the $20 million sales mark and is the largest selling program in the history of business cassette publishing. Roger has written 6 books, the latest of which is Roger Dawson's Secrets of Power Negotiating from Career Press. This book was featured in the main section of the Money Book Club and was the first book ever to be featured in an 8-page supplement both in Success Magazine and Working Women Magazine. Roger was born in England and came to this country in 1962. His business background includes being president of one of California's largest real estate companies, with 28 offices, 540 sales associates, and a volume of over $400 million per year. As a full-time speaker since 1982, he has trained managers and salespeople at the top companies throughout the United States, Canada, and Australia. This month, Roger will share 2 portions of his new award-winning tape program, Secrets of Power Negotiating for Contractors. Roger will tell us how reading body language and knowing the hidden meanings of conversation can improve your negotiating skills.
In this session, we're going to talk about how power negotiators read body language. Unfortunately, body language is a subject with which many people get carried away. And I think that's true of a lot of other areas, too. I've met people who believe in astrology so much they won't even leave the house on a particular day when their sign's not right. Some people believe so strongly in handwriting analysis that they won't hire someone whose handwriting doesn't conform to their system. I've even heard of people who believe that they can spot someone who's committed a murder from the way they write. And many years ago, I lost a job because I couldn't interpret an ink blot test accurately. We don't want to go that far with body language. But it's true that a great amount of our communication is nonverbal. Remember we talked about this when we were discussing flinching, the importance of the visual reaction to a negotiating proposal? As much as 80% of the reaction that people have to what is going on in the negotiation can be nonverbal. If you want to illustrate how much we can communicate without speaking, at your next staff meeting, go around the room and ask everybody to tell you something non-verbally. For example, a thumbs-up gesture means good. A thumbs-down gesture means bad. A shrug of the shoulders means indifference, and so on. I've done it with as many as 50 people and haven't come up with a shortage of different gestures. And I suspect that you can do it with 100 people and still be going strong. So there's an awful lot we can do and communicate non-verbally. However, if we get carried away, we can easily misunderstand gestures. For example, women much more naturally cross their arms than do men. It's just a more comfortable position for them. If we interpret that as shutting us off, we can be misreading the situation completely. If we see somebody tug their ear while they're in a conversation with us, and we automatically think that means they're asking for more information, when in actual fact their ear may just be itching, it can be a big mistake. Particularly if you're dealing with people of other nationalities, you can make serious mistakes. Do you know that while in this country when you nod your head it means yes, and to shake your head means no, to an Eskimo exactly the opposite is true? But let's not get carried away. You won't be negotiating with many Eskimos. But let me tell you the story of probably the biggest nonverbal misunderstanding of all time. Back in 1960, when the American space effort had been embarrassed by the success of Sputnik, what President Kennedy decided to do was to give us a giant national goal that would draw us all more closely together. And that goal would be to put Americans on the moon within that decade. And we were to make everything public. The people would see the successes, the failures, and the public would rally around this grand, exciting goal for the following 10 years. And that's pretty much the way it worked. And on July 20th, 1969, when our men finally stood on the moon, there were over a billion people watching on television. The greatest communication extravaganza of all time. And when Neil Armstrong was asked, "What's it like up there?" he replied nonverbally, using an A-OK gesture with his hand. Now, that was fine for millions of Americans that were watching, because the A-OK gesture is traditionally American and very well understood. But for the other billion or so of people watching on television, the gesture was completely misunderstood. Because it's very similar to a gesture that's known around the world, where when the thumb is touched to the center finger, it's a hostile gesture bordering on obscene. You may think of it as an Italian gesture, but it's worldwide. And one can't help believing that some Japanese television commentator might have said to the other, "What did he say? What did he say?" And the other one might have said, "I don't know, but he seemed awfully mad." The importance of body language tells you that it's usually a mistake to negotiate over the telephone. Let's say that you stop by a developer's office to take him to lunch and go over a shopping center project that he has coming online soon. You see through the glass wall of his office that he's on the phone, so you decide to wait outside. He's leaning back in his chair with his feet up on his desk and the phone tucked under his chin. He's making a steepling motion with his hands, a sure sign of confidence. All of a sudden, his feet come down off the desk, he's sitting upright in his chair, and he starts patting his pockets looking for a pen. He looks over to his secretary, touches his thumb to his forefinger, and waggles his hand. She knows what this means, so she gives him a pen, and he starts to write on his pad furiously. When he gets halfway down the pad and he's finished writing, he draws a big line on the bottom of it and puts a big check mark there. Then he stands up, goes around the chair, pushes it under his desk, and starts leaning on the back of his chair as he talks. At that point, he sees you waiting outside, gives you a thumbs-up sign and another sign with the thumb and forefinger separated slightly to indicate that he'll only be a couple of minutes, and continues to listen. Then a worried look comes on his face, and as he responds, he touches the side of his nose, an almost sure sign that he's either exaggerating or lying. When he reaches down, making some further adjustments to the figures on his pad, he starts to smile again and reaches for his coat and has it halfway on as he concludes the conversation and hangs up the phone. The point I'm making here is, look how much more you knew about what was going on in that conversation than did the person on the other end of the phone, even though you couldn't hear a word. That's why we suggest that you almost never negotiate over the telephone. Always take the time to go meet the person face-to-face so that you can tell their body language. Particularly, you can tell much better if they're getting upset, so you can adjust your responses appropriately. The other bad thing about negotiating over the telephone is that you can't shake hands. And in this country, a handshake to settle a deal is such a powerful negotiating tool that you should never be in a situation where you can't seal the deal by doing it. Another important thing to remember is that people believe what they see much more readily than they believe what they hear. For example, if I say to you, "Well, I'm not going to let it worry me," but when I say it to you, I have my hands in my pockets, my shoulders are slouched, my head is hung low, and I have a worried expression on my face, which would you believe? Am I worried or not? Of course you'll believe what you saw rather than what you heard. If you're an analytical, our session on body language will not be nearly detailed enough for you. It'll appear very superficial. But if you're like me, I think you'll learn enough in our short session here to get you started in your study of body language. We'll give you some basic fundamentals that you can work with that directly apply to the negotiating process. And from there, you can continue your own study. And there are two key places where you could continue to study. One is waiting in an airport. Instead of getting frustrated by the wait, start getting fascinated by the people around you. Observe the people who are beyond your hearing range. You can't hear them, but you can see them. Study their postures and their body language. Try to interpret what they're doing, particularly the people that are on the telephone in that row of booths. Try to figure out to whom they might be talking. Is it a wife, a lover, a customer, or an employee? You can probably tell with a little practice just by reading their body language. Remember, though, that only a change in body language is a valid sign to read. Don't assume because somebody has their arms folded that they're hostile. The thing to watch for is when something is apparently said that causes them to suddenly fold their arms. That's when body language becomes significant. I once met with an expert on body language who was frequently hired by attorneys to be present in the courtroom to watch the body language of the witnesses. And this is what he told me is the key issue. Watch for changes in body language. Just because a witness may have a habit of scratching his nose, it doesn't mean that he's necessarily lying. It may just mean he has an itchy nose. But if, when asked a certain question, all of a sudden his hand involuntarily goes up to the side of his nose, it's a pretty good indication that he's lying. Incidentally, you can watch that same gesture when you're watching Johnny Carson start his show. He typically says, "We've got a great show for you tonight." But sometimes you'll see his hand involuntarily go up to the side of his nose, indicating that he really doesn't think it's that great a show. Back to the witness in the courtroom. He told me, just because their finger may go to their collar frequently, it doesn't necessarily mean that they feel a lot of pressure. It may just be that they have a brand new shirt on which hasn't been washed yet, and it's stiff and uncomfortable. However, if under the pressure of a particular part of the questioning, then their hand goes to their collar, it definitely means they feel they're under pressure. This is where my friend would step in, bring it to his attorney's attention, and during cross-examination, the attorney would re-emphasize this point to try and find out what was really going on in the witness's mind. Watching television is a fascinating way to study body language. We mentioned Johnny Carson, but try watching news commentators with the sound turned off. Watch for the blinking of their eyes. Watch for the hand movements. Watch for the gestures. And you'll be amazed at how much you can tell about the kind of story that they're relating. In England, they have an expression that says, "He's a blinking liar." Probably without realizing that he was reading body language, he's noticed that the other person's eyes are blinking at a very rapid rate. This is a very sure indication that the person is either exaggerating, lying, or feels very uncomfortable with what they're having to say. If you watch a news commentator with the sound off so that you can concentrate better, you'll be amazed to see the different frequency of eye blinks. When they're uncomfortable with a news story they're having to read, you'll see their eye blink rate go up maybe 4 or 5 times. Now let's consider the actual negotiating session and how body language plays a part. First of all, the handshake. There are many different ways of shaking hands. Generally, in this country, an acceptable handshake is firm, but not too strong, several steady shakes. And usually we don't use the other hand, although with a well-known acquaintance we may shake with both hands. In other words, we put our left hand over the back of the other person's hand. This is considered a little too forward by many people, particularly when you meet for the first time. It's called the politician's handshake. Another variation of this is grasping the other person's forearm with your free arm. That's known as the minister's handshake. And yet again, there's putting your hand on the other person's shoulder as you shake his hand, and that's a sure signal that he wants you for a committee. Be careful about any variation from the standard familiar handshake. Obviously, a damp palm is a sign of nervousness, so look for the person who wipes their hand on their coat as they raise their hand to shake yours. A few years ago, it was unheard of for a gentleman to offer his hand to a lady before she had indicated that she wanted to shake hands. But now, in today's enlightened society, I'm inclined to think that men should offer a hand to a lady in a business situation. But I'm still very conscious of this as I travel around the country giving power negotiating seminars. The customs are very clearly different in different parts of America. In the South of America, for example, Alabama, Mississippi, the Florida Panhandle, and so on, I'm still reluctant to offer to shake a lady's hand. It's also true in the Bible Belt states, such as Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska. So be careful, and be sure that you're in accord with the local customs in that area. Power negotiators understand that the way you sit around the negotiating table can affect the outcome. If you're alone and negotiating against two other people, such as the vice president in charge of construction and the president of the development company, be sure you don't seat yourself between them. Because if you do, they can exchange glances and signals between each other without you being able to catch them. Also, of course, you can't watch the body language as easily as you could if you have them seated across the table from you. How do you control where they sit? Be sure that you have them sit down first and then position yourself across the table, not on the same side. When a large group is negotiating and there are equal numbers on each side, it's typical for them to sit on opposite sides of the table. If the groups are unevenly numbered, then the larger group will try and maintain that same separation so that their larger numbers on one side of the table can dominate the other side. However, if you are a member of the smaller group, you'll want to attempt to split up the seating arrangement so that your team is dispersed among the other members of the group. It tends to eliminate that feeling of being overpowered. When two people are on the same negotiating team sit together, they tend to be perceived as speaking with one voice, whereas if they split up, they tend to be able to present two opinions, which gives them more strength. So let's say that you have one other person on your side, and they bring in three people, and you're sitting around at a round table. You wouldn't want to sit together. Having met everybody and seated yourself at the table, the next thing to consider is, when should the small talk stop and the serious negotiating begin? Power negotiators know that it's always good to relieve tensions with some inconsequential banter to get everybody feeling comfortable and ready to go. But when do you get down to business? Power negotiators watch for two signs. One is smoking. Contrary to popular opinion, people don't smoke when they're nervous. They smoke when they're relaxed. And I've proven this time and time again. I've had someone come into my office feeling nervous and uptight, possibly feeling that they're in trouble. And if I know they smoke, I'll continue with the small talk until they feel relaxed enough to light up a cigarette, and that's when we can get into business. So when you have members of the team that smoke, a sure sign that they're comfortable enough and relaxed enough to start the serious negotiating is when they light up a cigarette. The other sign is the coat button phenomena. Men will normally keep their coat jacket buttoned until they feel more comfortable with you. So if you have members of the group who still have their coats buttoned, keep on with the small talk until they reach down and relax by opening their jacket. There was a survey done once at a wedding reception where the person doing the survey didn't know whether the people who were there were members of the family or just invited guests. And they were able to tell with 80% accuracy who was there as a member of the family because their coats were unbuttoned, whereas the people who were strangers to the group kept their coats buttoned much longer. As you look around the negotiating table, try to study how frequently people's eyes blink. If you haven't done this before, you'll probably be surprised at how frequently we blink our eyes. Up to 60 times a minute is not unusual, although some people are much slower, around 15 to 20 blinks per minute. You'll need this information later because when a person's eye blink rate changes dramatically, you'll know that they're either very alert to what you're saying or under a high degree of tension, and they may not be telling the truth. The tilt of the head tells you whether people are paying attention to you or not. People whose heads are completely upright as they look at you are probably not paying attention. A slight tilt to the head, particularly if it's accompanied by a hand going up to the chin, is a very good indication that they're paying good attention. Speakers learn to study this. We can spot the members of the audience who are paying close attention by the tilt of the head. And if we have a large segment of the audience who is sitting there with a perfectly straight heads, even if they have a smile on their face and appear to be paying attention, we know that they're not. So we'll direct a question to that segment of the audience for which a response is required, or we'll change pace or in some way make that section of the audience more alert. Of course, if a speaker notices that people are leaning towards the door, it's a good body language signal that they're losing interest. Watch carefully any time the hand goes to the head. A stroking of the chin with the thumb and forefinger indicates they're very interested in what you're saying. Knuckles folded and under the chin reveals the same kind of interest. But when the chin goes into the heel of the hand and the head leans on the hand, it's a clear sign of boredom. When a person strokes the side of their nose, it's almost a clear indication that they're exaggerating or lying to you, unless it's a normal nervous mannerism of theirs. When a person tugs at their ear, they're saying to you, "I want to hear more about what you have to say." When a person scratches the top of their head, they're embarrassed or uncomfortable with what's going on, so you might want to back off and change direction. I know this all sounds rather far-fetched to you, but your analysis of this in the negotiating situation will prove the value of watching the other person very carefully. What can we learn from the hands? We know that fingers drumming on the tabletop indicate impatience, and we know that under severe strain, people may wring their hands. But watch for steepling, too. Steepling means two hands with just the tips of the fingers touching without the heels of the hands meeting. It's an indication of supreme confidence. It's very difficult to do that when you're extremely nervous. So if you see somebody doing that, you know they feel themselves to be in a superior position. When a man brings one or more hands to his chest, it's a sign of openness and sincerity. Although when a woman does it, it tends to be one of shock or protectiveness. Touching the bridge of the nose, particularly when it's accompanied by closed eyes, means the person is really concentrating on what's going on. A hand placed at the back of the neck, whether it's a finger inside the collar or a palm rubbing in the back of the neck, is a sure sign of annoyance. People really do get hot under the collar, and they really do feel that you're a pain in the neck sometimes. What can you tell from a person who wears glasses? Well, you know what looking over the top of the eyeglasses means. It means, I don't believe you, or I disapprove. Someone who repeatedly cleans their glasses, and this can happen 3 or 4 times an hour during a negotiation, is certainly the same thing as a pipe smoker who's constantly relighting his pipe. It simply means that they need more time to think about it. So a power negotiator will either stop talking or talk about something inconsequential while the other side mulls over the more important points. Anytime somebody puts something in their mouth, whether it's an eyepiece of their glasses or a pen or a pencil, think of it as needing more nourishment. They like what they hear, but they want to hear more. Of course, if somebody took their glasses off suddenly and tossed them on the table, you'd know that they were upset with you and they were shutting you off. But watch for this when it's a more subtle signal, too, when they're just laying their glasses down. If somebody takes their eyeglasses off and lays them down on the table, it means they're no longer listening to you. Another fascinating part of body language is to consider how much space you should give a person when you're communicating with them. This study of how close you should get to another person in the negotiating process has a name all to itself. It's called proxemics. Researchers have determined that anything less than 1.5 feet is the intimate zone, and you shouldn't intrude upon it without permission. From 1.5 feet to 4 feet is the personal zone, and beyond 7 feet is the public zone. But there are a lot of variables here. One is the national background of the person with whom you're talking. People who come from very crowded countries, such as England where I was raised, or Japan, are much more comfortable in a crowded environment than Americans tend to be. At the same time, we can shut ourselves off more easily. We can be alone in a crowd much more comfortably than an American who's more used to wide open spaces. So you can get closer to an Englishman or a Japanese without them feeling pressured. And of course, the same applies to someone who's raised in a city like Los Angeles, Chicago, or New York, as opposed to someone who is raised in a wide open rural environment. The other variable is your size in relationship to the person to whom you're talking. If you're talking to someone who's considerably shorter than you, you must stand back considerably further than you would with someone your own height. Otherwise, you tend to overpower that person. Another way that you can lessen this overpowering effect is to turn sideways a little bit as you talk to the person so you don't project a gigantic wall. As if I haven't given you enough challenges, now I want to add one more dimension to power negotiating, and that is looking for the hidden meanings in conversation. Whenever a president of the United States makes a speech, he invariably reads it, particularly if it involves foreign affairs, because every single word in that speech will be analyzed, put under a microscope by the other countries to determine exactly what he meant to say. And very often, what's left out of a speech will be just as meaningful to them as what went in. When you know that someone who's very skilled at analyzing conversation will be picking apart every word, it's very difficult for you not to give away something on the hidden side of your negotiating agenda. That's the power of learning the hidden meanings in conversation. And if you're aware, as you will be, of course, of your hidden agenda in the negotiations, it's not difficult for the other party to learn a lot about that hidden agenda from studying the way you talk. So not only must you be skillful in analyzing their hidden meaning, you must be careful not to give away your own hidden meanings. One defense the presidents of the United States have in this matter, of course, is to send their press secretary to make announcements and not let him know the information the administration wants to keep secret. I was involved in a negotiation that would have led to the merger of two companies. One of the skeletons we had in our closet was that one of our major stockholders was in serious financial straits and was very, very anxious to make the merger at any price. We didn't want the other side to know this, of course. At one point in the negotiations, the president of the other company said, "I'm concerned about your relationship with Mr. X. I feel if we ran a credit check on him, we'd find that he has serious financial problems." The manner in which the statement was made puzzled me. He didn't say that he had run a credit check on him, which he was perfectly capable of doing, and he didn't start off his sentence with, "As you're well aware, Mr. X has credit problems." He had said, "If we were to run a credit check." This alerted me to the fact that he was in contact with someone within our organization who had passed this information on to him. Later on in the conversation, he said to me, "Roger, you're an outside director of the corporation," which means while I sat on the board of directors, I didn't work for the corporation. He continued, "I understand that you recently spent an entire day at the company interviewing all of the key employees. That's a strange thing for an outside director to do. Why did you do that?" Well, I'd done it because I suspected some severe conflicts within the ranks of the organization, although it hadn't turned out as badly as I feared. I didn't know quite how to respond to his question until I remembered how he had phased the previous question, and the suspicion that someone within our company was feeding him information. Based on that response, I immediately knew that he had already read my confidential report from that day's activities, and I responded accordingly. If I hadn't figured out that he'd read my report, I could have made some embarrassing mistakes. The lesson here is to listen very, very carefully to the words that people use. If something strikes you as being strange, jot it down word for word and analyze it later. Let's take a look at the hidden meanings in conversation that tell you they mean exactly the opposite of what they appear to be saying. If someone starts off a conversation with, "In my humble opinion," they probably mean exactly the opposite. They're not humble, they're egotistical. In fact, they're so great they can profess to be humble. When you ask an opinion of someone and the person responds, "Well, he's a fine church-going person," this probably means that the fact he goes to church on Sunday is his only attribute. And if someone says to you, "We can work out the details later," that probably means there's quite a bit of negotiating to be done yet. You're not as close to agreement as he wants you to believe. Remember that we talked about that one in our session on time pressure? And the classic, of course, is, "Don't worry." If your daughter calls you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and says, "Daddy, don't worry," what should you do? Start worrying. There's another group of expressions that should cause sirens to go off in your mind because they tell you that what follows is important. Power negotiators call them throwaways. They are, "As you're aware," "Incidentally," "Before I forget," and "By the way." They may say, "As you're aware, we're completing this construction under Chapter 11. Well, of course, you weren't aware of that. It's a major point, and they just tried to drop it in at the tail end of a sentence. Incidentally, "As you're aware," "Before I forget," and "By the way," these throwaway expressions usually precede a monumental announcement. The classic of all was President Truman meeting with Churchill and Stalin at Potsdam, Germany in July of 1945. The war in Europe was over. The war in Japan was still going on. Truman had told Churchill that we had the atomic bomb, but he had not told Stalin. And over dinner that night and a few vodkas, Truman said, "Oh, by the way, Mr. Stalin, we have the atomic bomb." Mr. Stalin responded, "Oh, yes, we're aware of that." Of course, he wasn't. Exactly the opposite was true. So even the most dramatic pronouncements can be preceded by these throwaways like, "As you're aware," "Incidentally," "Before I forget," and "By the way." So perk up when you hear them. Look also for legitimizers, expressions such as "frankly," "honestly," "to tell the truth." They usually try to legitimize a statement which is not fully true. When somebody says to you, "Honestly, I don't think we could live with a proposal like that," What does he mean by honestly? Has he been dishonest up to now? Or could it be that he's just trying to add a little more convincing power to what he's telling you because he doesn't believe it himself? One of the best-known expressions in American literature is one of the last lines in Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, when Rhett Butler says to Scarlett O'Hara, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." Students of language and of hidden meanings in conversation would instantly pounce on that word, frankly. It's a legitimizer. He was trying to legitimize what he really didn't believe. Justifiers are words which lay the foundation for failure. Expressions such as, "I'll try my best," or "I'll see what I can do," or "I'll try to keep it under $300. All of these expressions fall far short of a firm commitment, don't they? And they're preparing you for the fact that they may fail. So unless you're willing to live with that, challenge it at that point. Even worse is when a justifier is changed into the plural. Instead of saying, "I'll give it every effort," all of a sudden it becomes, "We'll give it every effort," hiding behind the group. No salesperson worth his salt will ever accept an owner or general saying, "Well, I'd like to think it over." Remember I gave you the way to avoid that when we talked about the higher authority gambit? But if the "I" changes to "we," then look out. You'd better do something fast or you're not going to get the job. Let's say the owner during the entire negotiation has been saying, "Well, I don't think I can afford to pay that much," or "I wouldn't be willing to do that," or "I would have to get you to," and then all of a sudden he switches to, "Well, we'll have to think it over," or "We'll give you a decision tomorrow," you're in serious trouble. And you'd better get back in there and do some more selling because it's just not going to fly. Power negotiators are also alert to erasers. These are words that tell you to erase anything that's been said before. They reverse the entire meaning of what was said before. The two most popular erasers are the words "but" and "however." Someone can tell you for 10 minutes how much they enjoy their work and may look like a sure thing to go with you. And then they say "but" or "however." You might as well erase those 10 minutes of positive feedback, and you know you'll have to start again, because the eraser words "but" and "however" literally erase everything that's been said before. A key phrase to listen for is the deceiver. When the eraser is preceded by a sentence such as, "I'm just a country boy," but, or, "I'm no student of the law, however," or, "I never graduated from college, but," or, "I've never fully understood it, however," "It's none of my business, but," these are all called deceivers, and that's exactly what they attempt to do. For example, when somebody says to you, "I'm just a country boy," they mean far from that. In fact, somebody once said that to Lyndon Johnson when he was in the White House, and Lyndon Johnson, who was himself a country boy, exploded and said, "Listen, mister, in this town, when somebody says that to me, I feel like putting my hand on my wallet." If somebody tells you they're no student of the law, they may not be, but you can be assured that they know exactly what they're talking about in that particular instance. A group of sentences which are very important to salespeople are called preparers. When a salesperson says to you, "I don't mean to be personal," you can be sure that he's about to be very personal. "I don't mean to be personal, but when did you file bankruptcy?" When he says, "I don't want to intrude," what is he about to do? When he says, "I don't want to intrude," what's he about to do? Intrude. Another way to prepare people for a potentially difficult question is to exaggerate how difficult it's going to be for you to answer. Let's say that an equipment supplier wants to ask you what your income was last year because they're filling out a credit application. They may say to you, "This is very embarrassing, but..." Now, in those 3 seconds, all kinds of things are running through your mind about how embarrassing this could be. And when you find out the only thing they're asking you for is your income, it's much easier to take. Someone might say to you, "I need a big, big favor." You're thinking he's probably going to ask for $1,000 or at least $500. And when they ask you for $50 or $100, it seems like such a little thing. So look out for that one. In the negotiating process, you'll frequently encounter trial balloons. These are the type of sentences that start off with, "I haven't given it a lot of thought, but," or, "Just suppose we," or, "Off the top of my head, I would think that," or, "What would happen if we?" The other side has made up its mind they'd like to try something, but they're not sure if you'll go along with it. So they're sending up a little trial balloon. This tells you two things. First of all, it tells you that they would accept what they're suggesting, however little thought they claim to have given it. So in effect, they've narrowed their negotiating range. Secondly, it also tells you that they're not sure you'll accept it, so you can probably do a lot better if you push a little harder. Another important part of hidden meanings in conversation is the realization that people tend to be oriented to one particular sense of perception. By that I mean that we all interpret everything we experience through our different senses, like sight, hearing, feel, or taste. Most of us have an orientation towards one of those senses. Taste is the most unusual. The most popular ones you'll encounter are sight, hearing, and feeling. And you can tell which orientation a person has by the kind of language they use. Let's suppose, for example, three people go together to a symphony concert. The three people are an oil painter, a piano player, and a poet. If their dominating perception follows their professions, you would expect that the oil painter would be primarily sight-oriented. What he sees will be much more important than what he feels or hears. Whereas the piano player will be oriented to hearing. What he hears will be more important than what he sees or feels. And the poet will be oriented to his feeling. What he feels will be more important than what he sees or hears. So each one of them will come away with a different interpretation of what happened. Although the orientations of the people you'll meet as a power negotiator may not be that pronounced, they still exist and they can still be important to your strategy. They'll reveal their orientation by the way they talk. For example, a person whose orientation is through sight, like the oil painter, will say things like, "Yes, but will our people see it that way?" Or, "That looks good to me." Or, "I see what you mean." Whereas the person like the piano player, who is oriented to hearing more than sight or feeling, will say, "That sounds good to me," or, "I hear you." And the person who's primarily a feeling type person, like the poet, will say things like, "I feel good about this," or, "I can warm to that suggestion." So it follows that if you're negotiating with someone who's primarily visual, you'll want to use a presentation binder. Or go to a chalkboard and draw it out for them so he can actually see it. This won't be so important with someone who has an auditory orientation. In fact, you could even turn off somebody like this. They might even resent you visually explaining what you just said. Their inner language may be saying, "You don't have to paint a picture for me. I heard you the first time." Be sure you mirror people's conversations. If people are in the auditory mode, they're saying, "That sounds good to me." Don't respond with, "Well, that looks good to me, too." Among people who study this kind of thing, that's called a crossed response. As with the study of body language, there are people who can get completely carried away with the study of hidden meanings in conversation. Don't do that, but learning the fundamentals can be very rewarding. What we've given you here, of course, is a very brief overview. As you become more aware of the subject, as you study more closely what people say, and as you learn to interpret with more skill what people say, you'll become more interested in it, and your knowledge will automatically grow. Throughout this power negotiating program, I've always tried to emphasize the win-win philosophy, that the answer to negotiations is not to dominate the other person, but to achieve a win for them also. Always remember that people will give you what you want when you've been able to give them what they want. I've tried to stress my conviction that in any negotiation, the object is not to beat your opponent, but rather to creatively reach an agreement in which each negotiator can feel he's a winner. I maintain that in every negotiation, no matter what the objectives of each side, both sides can win. More than that, I've been saying that both should win. So let's talk about the benchmarks of power negotiating. These standards are no more lenient than those used by the silver craftsmen in Old England as they hammered their mark into their wares. These standards can help you determine not only whether you won or lost, but how you played the game. The first benchmark you should consider is whether everyone involved in the negotiation feels like a winner. You're not a power negotiator if the other party walks away from the table thinking, "Is he a great negotiator? I can't believe it. He talked me out of everything." Rather, a good negotiation has been completed when both parties can walk away from the table feeling as though they had accomplished something important. The second benchmark of power negotiating is the feeling both sides should have for each other. Each seemed to care about the objectives of the other. If you felt that the other person was listening to you, and if not being gratuitous, then at least was taking into consideration your needs, and if the other party had the same feeling about you, then you as a negotiator probably succeeded in creating an atmosphere of communication in which a win-win settlement could be reached. The third benchmark of power negotiating is that each side must feel the other was fair in the way they conducted the negotiations. A football team doesn't mind losing the game nearly so much if they know that the other side was playing by the rules. A political candidate doesn't mind his loss so much if he believes that his opponent has waged a fair and reasonable campaign. But where there's foul play, or a rule is broken, or something sneaky is going on, that negotiation really suffers from the feelings of betrayal. The attitudes of both parties as they leave the negotiation should be, well, they were tough and they fought hard, but they did listen to my point of view. I believe that they were fair in the way they conducted the negotiations. Benchmark number four of power negotiating is that each negotiator would enjoy dealing with the other at some time in the future, like two chess players leaving a match. If the game was conducted fairly, then each would want to play the other again, not to outdo the other or get revenge, but simply because the process of playing together was enjoyable and challenging. The fifth mark of power negotiating is that both sides leave determined to keep the commitments made in the agreement. Each side knows that the other side would uphold the conditions of the agreement. If either side feels that given the opportunity, the other side would back down from his promises, then that negotiation was not a win-win negotiation. My definition of a win-win power negotiator, then, is a person who can get what he wants out of a negotiation and still meet the standards established by these five benchmarks. And a losing negotiator is someone who has not filled the requirements of those benchmarks, no matter how many of his own objectives he gained in the negotiation. It's important to understand that every person acts only in his self-interest, and must therefore be motivated from that base. This is called needs negotiating by international negotiators. This philosophy stresses the point that people will only act in order to meet their own needs, not to meet the needs of someone else. In order to reach a workable agreement, the winning negotiator respects the needs and values of the other person and works actively to satisfy those needs as well as his own. Spend some time with the ideas that we've discussed. If you'll work to apply them in everyday situations in your contracting business, you'll acquire a surprising amount of control in any situation in which you're dealing with other people. Use these techniques to help you reach the level of success that you desire for yourself. And remember, everything that you need or want is currently owned or controlled by someone else. Now you have the skills that you'll need in order to deal with those people more effectively. It's up to you to use them ethically to reach an agreement that's to the advantage of everyone concerned. A win-win power negotiation. This is Roger Dawson, wishing you good luck in all of your negotiations.
We hope this edition of the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month has given you many new ideas to help you run your company more effectively. Don't forget to phone, fax, or call in your order for Service Sense. The order form is enclosed. Order today and get a free tape album. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy and Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.